Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, an exploration of imagination and fiction in the age of Harry Potter. This is episode one of our podcast, and a very special episode it is. We are calling it Reading, Writing, Rolling, Roanoke, because we're podcasting from the Roanoke Harry Potter Fest. Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, an exploration of imagination and fiction in the age of Harry Potter. I'm Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2. Joining me, as always, is our resident expert, John Granger, the Dean of Harry Potter Scholars and the author of the Deathly Hallows Lectures. John blogs at hogwartsprofessor.com. and podcasts with me on Reading, Writing, Rolling at MuggleNet. So, John, you excited about our upcoming show?
I am excited about this show. This is the whole point. I've flown in from Oklahoma for this. This is it. This is the peak of the mountain.
And it's good to have everybody in person. We can all see each other.
As the Dean of Harry Potter Scholars, it means that I'm sort of the headmaster at hogwartsprofessor.com. Having these witches and wizards here is a wonderful thing.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Pretty cool. So let me announce who our other faculty are for tonight's show. Joining us today are some serious Potter scholars, including Lana Whited, Minister of Magical Education for Roanoke Harry Potter Fest. She teaches English and directs the honors program at Ferrum College and has two volumes on the Harry Potter series. I remember reading one of those very early on in my days as a Harry Potter scholar. Loved it. Thanks for putting together such a great event this weekend, Lana. I know it was a lot of work. So what are some of the highlights that you think happening tomorrow?
Well, I certainly think that the educational events with all of you guys speaking will be one of the highlights of the festival. And I'm really excited that we have five Wizard Rock bands coming to Roanoke.
We'll
be playing in various places. I'm excited about the fact that we have two vendors who are bringing butterbeer. I think for people who live in Roanoke, one of the most exciting things is that so many of the merchants downtown have bought in. And I was in a bar the other night that was mixing special drinks, serving fire whiskey through the weekend. And a cocktail called When Harry Met Ginny that obviously is a gin-based drink. We were in a restaurant earlier tonight with some great items on the menu that were Harry Potter themed. I had the Neville Long Bowl, which was quite delicious. So that's really exciting. And it's exciting for me. My adventure with Harry Potter began in Roanoke with a presentation that I gave over at Hotel Roanoke in a Children's Literature Association conference about 16 years ago now. So it feels like it's come full circle for me with this event.
Well, it's so great to see a community of Harry Potter scholars that has really developed in that period. So that's wonderful. Well, our next guest is Louise Freeman, a professor of psychology at Mary Baldwin University, a behavioral support clinician at Compass Counseling Services of Virginia, and a regular blogger at www.hogwartsprofessor.com. So Louise, can you tell us a little bit about what you're going to be talking about tomorrow?
Well, I have doing a couple of presentations on psychological conditions that are evident in the Harry Potter series, such as the Dementors being a manifestation of clinical depression, Mad-Eye Moody being a PTSD patient, or very much like a PTSD patient.
Probably should have been a patient.
Probably should have been a PTSD patient, yes. So I'm talking about basically psychology within the series.
That's great. And I think that as people read it, I think people often do feel like they identify with some of the things that are mentally, emotionally going on with the
story. Yes, that's part of what I'm talking about is actually a research project I did with some Mary Baldwin Honors students a couple of years ago now, where we surveyed our students, surveyed and kind of separated the Harry Potter readers from the non-Harry Potter readers. And what we found is that there was actually more tolerance, less stigmatization of people with mental illnesses among the Harry Potter readers. So I think that that speaks a lot for how the series may, in fact, influence people's thinking and particularly people's social cognition and relationships with others.
Wow, that's interesting. And, you know, it's so valuable to know that kind of thing, too. That's great. So our next guest is Elizabeth Baird Hardy, also of HogwartsProfessor.com. She's a senior instructor of English at Mayland Community College in Western North Carolina and the author of Milton, Spencer, and the Chronicles of Narnia. So I hear, Elizabeth, that you're going to be Professor Sprout tomorrow. Can you tell us what you're going to be doing?
Yes. For a little while, I get to put on my Professor Sprout robes, which is kind of fun because I usually approach Harry Potter from a very academic stance. And we're talking about kind of coming back full circle. One of the other presentations I'm doing tomorrow about magical beasts and their influence in Rowling from C.S. Lewis is actually grown from the very first presentation that I ever did at a Harry Potter conference many, many, many years ago, and it's kind of grown and changed over time, sort of like something that Hagrid likes to raise, a creature like that. It's really wonderful to get to put on the robes and have a little fun. But this is a program that actually is based on 18th century medicinal medicine, medicinal plants, and plants that are just as interesting and just as bizarre as anything that as Professor Sprout would have.
Like the mandrakes?
Yes, there is going to be a mandrake involved tomorrow. People have to just have to come and see. They have to see what's involved there.
It won't kill you when you uproot it.
Nobody has to wear earmuffs. Nobody has to wear earmuffs for this presentation. But it will be very interesting, very entertaining. And people, I hope, will realize that just because plants aren't necessarily being grown in a Hogwarts greenhouse doesn't mean they aren't magical, because some of these medicinal plants are really interesting, and some of them, quite frankly, are just as dangerous as a venomous tentacula.
Oh, no. But important information to know
about. Very useful. Good to know.
Yeah. All right. That sounds awesome. Well, our next guest is Emily Strand, who's the author of Mass 101 and professor of comparative religions at Mount Carmel College of Nursing. She also blogs at HogwartsProfessor.com, so Hogwarts Professor is very well represented here. Emily, now I know you have brought your family to the festival.
I have.
What are you looking forward to sharing with them about the Harry Potter experience?
Well, my husband has read all the books. I would not say he's nearly the fan that I am, although he does have this sort of, he appreciates certain aspects of it that I appreciate that he appreciates, you know, like things like Neville, you know, like he's a big Neville. In fact, I think his costume for the closing the Yule Ball is going to be Neville. So we're coordinated there. So he's more of a subtle fan, a little less out there with his.
Which Neville is he going to be?
The adult grown up Neville.
I was going to
say. Bearded Neville.
End of the series.
Be bearded Neville. Right.
Not Deathly Hallows beat up. No. We knew you were coming back.
Well, Neville. We'll see what happens, but, you know.
It's going to be a long day.
Kidding. And my son is almost six, and I've told many people, you know, I think Harry Potter is better, you know, when they're a little bit older. I think when they, you know, 10, you know, 8, maybe 9, 10. But, you know, and then I started thinking, so I haven't read him any of the books, and I started thinking, I'm taking the kid to a Harry Potter festival. It's a little cruel to have not read him any of it. So we started. I think we're on chapter 7 or 8 now. So he's very interested. So this is all. I mean, he is Harry in Diagon Alley right now. He's got his eyes wide and he's just looking around and asking these really great questions about the story. And you know, Mom, is Hagrid good or is he bad? What do you think he is? Oh, I think he might be good. Ooh, yes, very good. So Mom is beaming, and yeah, so I'm looking forward to seeing his reaction.
You know, there's nothing better than introducing somebody to Harry Potter for the first time, and especially when it's a kid.
And especially your kid.
Yeah. I've been trying to get my kids to read the Harry Potter books, and maybe trying too hard.
Well, maybe this is it.
But when they knew they were coming here, they did start to read it. Mm. So they're both about halfway through. Okay. So that's good. They'll be able to identify some of the important things. And I know you're talking about Quidditch tomorrow.
I am talking about Quidditch. And how Quidditch might mean more than what's on the surface, and how Quidditch might have things about it that point to the larger narrative in Harry Potter. I'm excited about that. I'm participating in a couple of panels, especially one about the spirituality of the books, and also one about Harry Potter as hero journey literature, which also brings in another great love of mine, which is Star Wars. So I'm excited to be bringing both the Quidditch and the Star Wars here, and the spirituality.
Yeah, it's the whole package,
exactly.
Right? That's great.
It's all related.
So thanks, everybody, for joining us in what I expect will be an interesting and a wide-ranging conversation about our favorite Harry Potter moments. The idea for this podcast came from Bloomsbury Publishers' idea for how to celebrate 20 years of Harry Potter, which is happening this summer. And they invited fans to submit their favorite Harry Potter moments, and they're going to select the top 20. The submission deadline is up for Bloomsbury, so you can't submit to them anymore. But they're going to come out with the final tally in June. But we are still thinking about our favorite scenes, events, and quotes from the series. And we thought, what better way to get in the festival mood than to talk about those favorite moments with each other? Right, John?
Right.
But how do we do that, John?
Yeah, it's silly. This is a silly exercise, Katie, you've set up here. Because it's really impossible to say what are the 20 best Harry Potter moments. There's got to be some kind of qualitative scale here. I'm across the table from Louise Freeman, scientist, social cognitive person, and she's saying, John, this is not going to pass any measure in terms of an authentic study or any kind of scaling. We need some kind of qualitative scale. Say best moments, relative meaning to the plot, a turning point in character transformation, an emotional effect on readers. What's the measure for best? Okay.
Highly subjective.
Yes. I want some objective measures, or some at least less subjective, more pointed subjective categories.
Well, yeah. So that's what we decided to do, just to organize our thoughts and get our thoughts moving a little bit on this. We thought we would create some categories through which we could talk about some of our favorite moments. And some of these categories have to do with, as you've said, sometimes they have to do with sort of important elements of the plot or great characters and their particular development. Some of them have to do with our admiration for J.K. Rowling's ability to surprise and amaze. Actually, we have a lot of moments about that. And others have a deep emotional resonance with us. And I think that we are going to try to explore the arc of the many kinds of reactions that these books have sparked from us. And hopefully by the end, we'll have 20 moments that we really do think are the top. And Emily is going to be our scribe. So as we get to ones that we think are really good moments, we're gonna champion them and say they meet that high bar to go in the top 20. We're going to keep the fighting to a minimum. Everybody has a chance. All right, but let's start with some of the basics, just to get us going on this. The center of the stories is the trio, Harry, Ron, Hermione. And we all have those moments that are really about them, about their friendship, about their development. And which one is your favorite? Lana, let's start with you.
Okay, I picked two. I'm cheating a little here already. They're both in Sorcerer's Stone. The first is the troll scene at Halloween, and I picked that one because Hermione is one of my favorite characters in the Harry Potter series. And early on, when Rowling introduced her, I thought, oh no, here's the stereotypical bookish, you know, bookworm, goody-two-shoes girl, and I was feeling kind of anxious about what Rowling was going to do with her, but she establishes really early in that scene that Hermione is capable of bending rules if loyalty to her friends requires it. Maybe that's what Hermione's doing in Gryffindor rather than in Ravenclaw, despite her considerable intelligence. My colleague, Catherine Grimes, who's going to talk about Lawrence Kohlberg and theories of moral development in the Harry Potter series tomorrow, would say that
that Kohlberg would say that morally that's a step back for Hermione, because Kohlberg puts loyalty to friends and family a step lower than loyalty to social principles, rules of the society, and so on and so forth. And that's been a really controversial aspect of Kohlberg's model. Carol Gilligan said he was wrong, that there was some gender bias in that. Anyway, but
I think J.K. Rowling thinks that's wrong, too.
I think J.K. Rowling thinks that's wrong, too.
Friendship ahead of that.
But I think that's the first of a series of situations in which Hermione can behave in some pretty surprising ways, right up to the time that she hits Draco Malfoy in the face. So, you know, right. It's pretty satisfying to me that she didn't turn out to be that stereotype that I was afraid she was going to be.
And
the other,
and Lana, sorry. That ends with a great sentence that I'm not going to be able to do. But it's something like, you know, there are some things that you can't go through together without emerging as friends, and killing a mountain troll or whatever, defeating a mountain troll is one of them. Yeah. I've totally mangled
it's
that.
It's a great line.
So
the other one is at the end of the same book, when Harry, Ron, and Hermione, when each of them uses his or her notable strengths to get to the Sorcerer's Stone. Harry's is obviously his flying and snatching ability. Ron's is his prowess at chess, and Hermione's is her superior logic with the potions riddle. And that foreshadows the many, many times in the series when the trio succeeds, not just by their strength and combination, but because they have confidence in the individual ability of one member of the trio. Also, many of the scenes that really are memorable to me are memorable because I have a strong emotional attachment to the scene. And with that one in particular, when I saw the film adaptation of Sorcerer's Stone, I went in Roanoke with some of my colleagues and their children. I was not a parent myself at the time. And we came out of that movie, and all the little girls in the group were really disappointed in that film because Hermione's riddle was left out of that scene. They talked about it all the way from their seats to the car and kept going. And I thought, you know, these children are doing feminist criticism on Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, and none of them was older than 12 at the time. And that was really, I think, my first insight into the level on which kids were going to connect really deeply with this series.
Yeah, and I do agree. Those seem like really foundational moments. And I saw Emily signaling that.
Especially, I think, the troll in the bathroom. I think that absolutely has to go on the top 20. I mean, because, like you said, that final line of that chapter, you know, this is what sealed the deal. You can't do this without becoming friends. And boy, is this is a world-saving friendship, you know, that is formed, that is forged in this girl's bathroom, you know, by this mountain troll. So I'm going to go ahead and take the liberty of writing that on our list.
I agree.
I want to say one more thing about that. The other thing that happens in that scene that tends to happen over and over in the series is that they miss something really exciting that's going on, like the Halloween feast, because they're off doing something, you know, that's life-changing. So I think that's in that scene as well.
Cool. Other trio moments. Elizabeth?
Some of the moments to me that are, because those big moments are so important, they're so critical, and they shape those characters. But I think it's sometimes easy to overlook some of those quieter moments that we see with those characters. And my favorites are the ones where Hermione is helping Ron and Harry with their schoolwork, which in some ways may seem kind of just conventional, like, oh, yes, they have to depend on her to do this. But I think it's really beautiful kind of showing her, especially as she matures, helping them with the schoolwork. The superiority begins to go away over time as she begins to realize that she is not just trying to show them up. She's trying to help them out. And really, let's face it, Ron and Harry are not the strongest students. And as a teacher myself, I always know who my Rons and my Harrys and my Hermiones are pretty early on in the semester, whether they are dual enrolled high school students or adult learners in a class. I always pick them out pretty quickly. And I just love those scenes. And one of my favorites is the one where she's marking out their feebler sentences. because not only is that just this beautiful scene of a friend helping a friend, but it also is what, as a community of scholars, we help each other. We help each other become better. And that's one of the things that's so great about this trio, is that they help each other to be better, whether it's something really cool and awesome like defeating trolls or just fixing that dangling modifier. And as a person who works with other people with their writing quite a bit, it made me feel like, well, I didn't knock out any trolls today, but I did fix a few dangling modifiers. So we all just contribute how we can. And I think those scenes are really sweet and important in their own way.
What Elizabeth said about helping each other to be better, that's what we're all doing here, right?
Exactly.
Absolutely. Yeah. Inspirational to each other. Yeah. Yeah, Louise, you had a good one here.
Yeah, I also picked a less pivotal moment, I guess I would say, than the mountain troll. I picked the scene in Grimmauld Place in Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows where they finally find out from Creature what has happened to the locket. And, you know, Creature is, you know, has been this nasty house elf who despises them all, particularly despises Hermione, the mudblood. And they've gotten the truth out of him, and he's, you know, broken and sobbing and weeping on the floor. And it was like the three of them suddenly together understood how am I going to relate to this elf. And when Hermione explains to them, this is how the house elves see the world, and she didn't understand that back in their days when she was forming Spew. I mean, that was the whole point. I mean,
knitting hats for house elves.
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
She's grown from
there. And trying, you're going to be free whether you want to or not. Here, hat. But Harry is there, has to be the decision maker, given that he now owns this elf now and can command him to do anything. And how is he going to use that control now that he has it? And just the fact that, Creature is going to go from this very despicable, nasty character to someone who is 100% loyal and faithful and is going to be making them shepherd's pie and all that type of stuff. And it really was the three of them. I mean, Ron was there sort of representing the wizarding view of house elves. He was the one who grew up knowing what these things are, growing up with slavery being an acceptable thing. And then Hermione sort of pointing out the emotional point, and then Harry being the decision maker. And I just thought that was a very nice moment where they came together. Again, like you said before, each sort of contributing their own strength, but wasn't a crucial, climactic scene in the book, but I really think it was a nice example of the three of them together.
And what I like about all the ones that have been talked about before is that they're all about forming the bond, and then in the little moments as well as the big moments, and then being able to externalize that to Creature and really bringing him in a way. That's really cool. Yeah. All right, I'll tell you what mine was. Jump in. It's in book 7 when Ron finally comes back to Harry and Hermione, and Harry comes back with Ron and Hermione's not having it, yeah. And she just attacks him. I heard J.K. Rowling read that passage aloud when she answered questions at Carnegie Hall, and her reading it, it was the best. They should put that on tape. She'd never do all of it. But just, you could tell she knew exactly how Hermione felt about that. And she's mad, but she's not that mad, and that she's bringing him back in. And I thought there was a maturity to that you could see the development of their relationship over those books. All right, John, you tell us what you think.
I thought Emily was going to jump
in. Oh, Emily?
Yes. Well, I mean, these quests, I feel like everyone's answers are so deep, and you all point to things that show this dynamic characterization. And I really just picked my favorite moment, which is when Harry's just come back from kissing Cho Chang and he's trying to explain, or Hermione is trying to explain how girls think to two people who don't get it and probably won't ever. And it's clear. And so, and then she accuses Ron of having the emotional range of a teaspoon, which is just, I mean, I have tried my hand at writing fiction in the past couple of years, and it's tough, but I think even doing that, it trains you to recognize places where authors are just coming from just a place of utter, just despairing honesty in their writing. And you can just feel the truth behind that line. You've got, just because you've got the range of a teaspoon, you know. It's just, it's very, it was very, it had to be very personal. And because that's what makes it so great, you know. And that was, that's really one of my, poor Hermione, you know, and poor Joe, and poor anybody who's been there. And poor Harry, and poor Ron, you know. It's just a great moment.
It is a great moment. I, for me, the trio has always been the heart of the series, in that if you identify with the trio in the series, Rowling's job is halfway done, because this, the story is about your transfiguration, your transformation inside the series. And if you identify with these three and you follow their relationship with one another, the soul triptych is going to turn itself right side up. That basically Ron will carry the luggage, Hermione will be assisting the spiritual side of this, and then Harry will be making the decisions. Now that mind, body, spirit thing is magnificent inside the series and how it works. But whenever I talk about this publicly, though, I always go to my favorite moment, because I always tear up and weep almost talking about it. And that's when Ron comes back after the first Triwizard task, and he comes into the tent and says, "Harry, I think someone's really trying to kill you." Then, like my namesake inside the series, the Granger person goes, "Ah!" You know, runs from the tent. You know, "You're all crazy." And that's exactly how I feel at the moment, because everything suddenly is right in the world again. We can go forward inside the book without this agonizing split of people being, and that's really is the most painful part of the books, is whenever the trio are not together. And so when they come back together, be it in the tent, you know, in Deathly Hallows, be it after the Chamber of Secrets problems with the broom. But really, to me, again, the goblet, when Ron finally realizes what a tool he is, and acknowledges that gracefully enough. Harry, about time. You know, Harry gets that one little bit of satisfaction and then says, "We're done. We're back. Forget it." That's so beautifully done. That's my favorite
one. And such an important part of friendship. Like, I think it models, you know, how to stay friends even through your, you know, very difficult moments with each other. Yeah, that was great. So, you know, the Triwizard Tournament to me is sort of an excuse to see some pretty cool magic, right? So next up are our top magical moments. Oh, and Emily has a Triwizard Tournament t-shirt on today.
Thank you, Hot Topic.
That's great. And Emily, you're first up on this one. So I'll tell you also that you and I had the same idea basically on this one. So what
it's
was
like
your...
we have one brain that we share.
So, and since I get the reference, it's even more true. Okay.
Of course you do.
So tell us what your idea for the top magical moment was.
Well, you know, I'm a big fan of those Weasley twins. And when they turn a school corridor into a portable swamp, and then because they're about to get whipped for it. I mean, literally, this is no joking matter, actually. You know, they do this stunt. And
it's Umbridge's Hogwarts.
It's Umbridge's Hogwarts. And they're actually going to get whipped, you know. And Filch is on his way. But they're like, "No, I don't think we are." Accio broomsticks. Because that's all it took, apparently, you know, to get their iron, you know, their chained broomsticks. And the chains are still, you know, the chains of their imprisonment are still swinging from the broomsticks dangerously at other students. The other students are backing away and cheering. And they use the moment as an opportunity to announce their new business, you know, and offer a discount for any students using their joke products as a way to disrupt Umbridge's Hogwarts. I mean, that's just, they're the best, they're disruptors, you know, and I know that's a term that's been, a label that's been thrown around recently, but these guys are the best kind of disruptors because they're disrupting injustice, and they really are, and they know what they're doing. And it's funny because the whole time they're acting as beaters in the game of Quidditch, because they're distracting the bludger away from its intended target, which is Harry. And Harry is actually, you know, off doing something somewhat important, sort of. somewhat important. He's doing Harry business, and they're distracting so that he can get that Harry business done. So in that grand Quidditch, you know, game, they're acting as the beaters there. And it's just the fireworks, the everything, the music from the film, just a great, great moment of magic, especially. Oh, Katie's pointing to my
notebook. I think you have to write that down,
all right,
Emily.
Oh,
I think
okay?
That's a great moment.
All right, the portable swamp.
That's good stuff. Other magical moments from the series. Stick with you. Lana.
Well, I would say the moment when Dobby gets them out of the cellar at Malfoy Manor, because it's really Harry's first recognition that elf magic is different. Lately, I've been really interested in the theme of otherness in the Harry Potter series, and I'm working on a book length project on that. But I think that's a great example of a time when Harry confronts the fact that people who are different from us have abilities and characteristics that might benefit others, and that it's worthwhile to pay attention to what those abilities are.
Yeah, and coming from a creature who some people would consider relatively powerless, right. Also. Yeah. Yeah. John, what did you have to say about that?
To me, the magic of the stories is all background. It's not that important. So I went for straight fireworks when the Dark Lord and Dumbledore go toe-to-toe in the Ministry of Magic. You know, the film made it all into, you know, light works. But in the book, it's terrifying. Mm-hmm. Here are the two most powerful wizards of the age, and they hate each other. This is going to the death, or Dumbledore at least is going to make it worse than death for the Dark Lord. He's going to capture him, humiliate him, maybe make him feel some remorse. While I was disappointed that Dumbledore didn't die in the scene, because I had predicted it publicly that he would die. I was the only person maybe in the multiverse that was cheering. Yeah. That was booing the stupid bird who interrupted that death curse. But for me, that was the magical moment.
Yeah, I think that's a big one. I think that should go in the top 20. That's a huge moment, that duel between Dumbledore and Voldemort. And that's the one time we see that, you know.
And indeed, I think you put a really good point there, John, that a lot of the magic is kind of like Fred and George. It's a distraction. It's, let's watch all this cool stuff going on. And I love the Fred and George magic. I do love the Marauder's Map. I got a mug for Christmas that, you know, it's one of those ones that is black, and you put the stuff in it, it turns into the map, which I got so excited over my mug. I was really, really excited about that. Because all those neat things, and I've often joked that I get into a lot of trouble with a time turner. So the only magical thing that I really need is Hermione's pocketbook. Really need that.
Oh, that would be a good one.
And I have actually been told that I already try to turn every bag, every purse, every pocket of every garment I own into Hermione's pocketbook, because it's all like stuff with little things. But in terms of like the real magic that's going on, it's not just bangs and noises and as everybody thinks that the twins are just up there, you know, they're just up there blowing stuff up. What do you know? They really were doing something kind of smart. It's kind of shocking. But the real magic to me is those relationships and how those things kind of shape and morph. And we were talking earlier about reading with our children and having them read. And I wouldn't let my children read the books. I had to read them to them. Because I'm not taking my hands off that. Mm-hmm. So to me, one of the most magical things has been that experience of reading the books aloud to my children. And that's why everybody has to be tiptoe around Isabella. We just finished with the Half-Blood Prince just a couple weeks ago. And that's why I said, I've got to turn in grades, honey. I can't do the Deathly Hallows just yet. Please get me through the end of the semester. And then I promise, because there's that one chapter where I have to do Bellatrix and Snape, and I have to do like everybody in that one.
You do the voices.
Oh, yes, I do voices. And so that's, to me, is one of the most magical things. And I think both of us, she and I both think this one scene, the hospital ward scene where Mrs. Weasley finally realizes that Fleur's okay. I love that scene because Fleur is, again, she's one of those characters that we just think, she's just a pretty face. She's just a flake. There's nothing to her.
I'm good looking enough for the both of us.
I'm good looking enough for the both of us. And yet when she says that, it's not vain. It's, this is what I do. And it's okay to be me. It's okay to be pretty. And you don't have to be pretty, but it's okay if that's what you are. And she's not stupid. She was a Triwizard champion. She's really sharp. And that wonderful moment, that look that comes over Mrs. Weasley's face. And that scene is also so wonderful because it is also the scene with Lupin and Tonks, which I cry over them a lot. a lot of cry movie talks a lot. But that scene I think was really wonderful, and reading that to my children, and that to me is real, that's the real magic to me, is the experience of it. It's not just sparks going off and neat things happening. It's what it does to us when we're reading it, that this magical thing happens to us. So that's the really neat spell that's happening.
Well, I went back to Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban for my top magical moment, because I picked the first time Harry conjures his Patronus, the full Patronus, the stag. And he's been working on this spell the entire book and, hasn't mastered it yet. Now he needs it. He's got to do it. It's a do or die situation. The stag appears and he realizes this is Prongs. Mm-hmm. As Dumbledore would later say, Prongs rode again last night. And just that it wasn't just a saving people thing. It was this connection to the father who gave his life for him. And he's made a connection back to his dad, and knows basically his dad in a way will be protecting him from now on. And I just, that was just a wonderful scene to me. That was probably just the most impressive single piece of magic, single spell cast in the entire series to me.
Yeah, that to me is such a resonant moment. And I thought, I was just signaling Emily, like, that has to be one of the top moments.
It's on the list.
It's already on the list. Yeah, it's because it's magic, but it's also spiritual, which I think is what Elizabeth was getting at the same time. It combines the two.
I'm the only guy present, so I'm going to nominate that when Sirius Black says to Harry, mm-hmm. "You are truly your father's son," mm-hmm. The men all leave the room because they need to take a phone call rather than weep publicly, because no man doesn't worry about whether he's his father's son sufficiently. Rowling marvels at things like Roddy Doyle being able to write a woman's character authentically as a man, as a son, as a father, as a husband. I'm always astonished at times how Rowling can drill what exactly makes a young man's heart beat quickly.
Yeah, just really powerful. And the third book is my favorite. And I think it's because of that scene. It's such a perfect way to bring all the themes together, I think. Right. All right. Well, we're headed in a more serious direction now. But we also want to sort of think about the text itself. And one of the things Rowling is so good at is kind of creating a text within a text, stories within stories that are kind of important as stories, but also for what they show you about the larger arc. So let's talk about some text within text, and Louise is going to start us off on this one. Louise, what did you think?
All right. Well, one of my favorite constructs in the book is the pensieve, mm-hmm. Particularly as a psychologist.
Right.
I'm very interested in memory, and none of our memories are perfect. The flaws in human memory and the biases in human memory are just one of the things I'm really interested in. Okay, so the Wizarding World solves that. They invent the pensieve, so you actually get to go back and see things, presumably as they actually happened. Mm-hmm. We have every indication that pensieve memories are true memories. They're just being played like a videotape, and you're seeing what is happening. So I love any use of the pensieve, basically. But the particular scene I picked was Tom Riddle's orphanage, mm-hmm. when we see Dumbledore go back, his first meeting with the person who will eventually be the most evil wizard in the world. And you see, most stories, when you go and see a child in an orphanage, you immediately feel sorry for this kid, feel compassion for this kid. And the young Tom Riddle is already torturing children, strangling bunnies, stealing from other kids. There's not a lot to like in this kid. He doesn't know what magic is, yet he's already learned how to use it to hurt people. And when you see that scene, you see that very bleak start he got to life. You know, he was an orphan in an orphanage, no love, no decent care or compassion shown to him. But then you see Dumbledore looking back on it, and you know what Dumbledore is thinking. You know, is there anything we could have done to set this kid on the right path, or were we too late? And it makes it just such a wonderful contrast to Harry, of course, who had an equally horrible upbringing, but did not turn out like that. And so that has to be my favorite story within the story, is the story of Tom Riddle's early life in the orphanage.
And that's a remarkable choice, Louise, because in Half-Blood Prince, we revisit that when we have the interview with the Dark Lord returns with his four Death Eaters out in the village, and Voldemort says to him, "I wish this were still the time when I could light up a wardrobe and mm-hmm. frighten you, mm-hmm. But we're well past that." Mm-hmm. That text within the text has its reflection also inside the text. That Rowling is saying, if you understand how to read these things, then you'll understand the book that you're holding in your hand. That to me is the marvel of all the texts that she puts inside. Every book has, if not an actual book, and oftentimes it is a book, there's a story being told inside the story that the people inside the story are coming to terms with while we are reading a book and trying to come to terms with it. And it's instructive to see how certain people read the books. And my favorite text was inside the text then is the prophecy, which is the text, which is really the driver behind all the other texts. I mean, Beetle the Bard, we get, you know, in book 7, it's a big deal. Hermione has to save the world, and she comes through. Good job, serious reader, Hermione. But with the prophecy, we get for 3 books, and everybody is reading it, trying to figure this thing out, trying to dope what's happened. And we see that Dumbledore has been struggling with this, and the Dark Lord hasn't got a complete text. He can't figure out what's actually happening. So for me, the prophecy has to go right up there as the text inside the text that drives all the texts and our understanding.
And it's funny, Louise and I had the same one, the Pensieve. It's kind of that story within the story, but it's interesting that idea of memory as being a story that we tell, because just like that prophecy, and everybody interprets that prophecy differently, memory, even when you take it right out of somebody's head and put it in a bowl and we can just go back through it, it's still not the same to everybody. And we don't always remember things the same way. And it would be really interesting to have different Pensieves and sort of compare, well, this was this person's memory of that exact same event, and is it really that way? Because no matter what, we're all storytellers. We're all telling ourselves a certain story. And we convince ourselves, I have to do this certain thing because of this prophecy. Or I could have done something in the past, and maybe I didn't. Or this is what happened, and maybe it really isn't what happened. So we're all sort of telling each other stories, but we're telling ourselves a story all the time. And sometimes it's not a true story, which I think in some ways a neat way to look at this whole experience is as all these different characters as storytellers, as the way they tell stories, whether it's, and honestly, we are really glad that we have this nice third person, limited, omniscient, just limited to Harry's point of view narrator for the most part. Because there are other characters who would have told the story. It would have been over really, really fast. Because that's what I always tell my students when we explain point of view. I said, you know, if we'd had like the Snape version, we wouldn't have had 7 books. We've had 7 pages. It's over. That's it. This is what happened. You know, this is the whole story. But because of that, because it's Harry, who's always, you know, not always quite figuring things out, maybe, the story is so important. So, you know, Beetle the Bard the Tale of the Three Brothers is so great because it really shows us folklore really working in the series, and it works as folklore. It sounds like a real, it's kind of a funny thing to say, isn't it? A real folktale. It sounds like that. It has that construct. It has that structure to it. But that's because we've been hearing all these different storytellers all the way through telling these stories, whether it's through their memories or what they're kind of telling themselves the whole time.
I agree. It really, with the Tale of the Three Brothers, it really, as a text within the text, it brought the spiritual theme to a point, to a head, and it showed what it was about Harry that allows him to be sort of invisible to death. Mm-hmm. And it's that he has this cloak, and whether you want to interpret that cloak as that charm of his on his blood by his mother's sacrifice, mm-hmm. you know, that just, you know, made him, gave him this literally this charmed life, mm-hmm. you know, or if it's, you know, I heard a theologian talking about grace one time, and she said, you know, there's a Protestant notion of grace that likens it to a cloak that hides our sinfulness from God. And I all of a sudden sat up in class. And I said, it's what? Actually, I was the teacher. She was a guest. I was like, it's a what? You know? And you know, it's so intense. You know, when you think about it that way, it's so intense. Harry does have this cloak of grace mm-hmm. that allows him to have the proper attitude toward death. And we know, we see that played out in just a few chapters later in the forest when he's got his cloak. I don't know what happened to the cloak. Is it stashed? I don't know where it is, but he's not using it. Mm-hmm. You know,
he hides it under his robes.
He hides it under his robes, and he sticks his wand in his pocket so he's not tempted to use it. Mm-hmm. And that is, and Dumbledore says, that made all the difference. Mm-hmm. That you were ready to accept death. You were standing before death, allowing it to take you. And that's what happens to the brother with the cloak in the story. He, you know, he lives a long life, and then he goes and meets death as a friend. You know, and death is a friend to Harry in that moment, because death is going to save all his friends. And that's just this beautiful moment where this text within the text becomes the text itself. That's my thing.
I chose the same choice there, the Tale of the Three Brothers.
Okay, we got to write it down. Let's write it down.
Yes. But not entirely for the same reason. Obviously, it does connect with the larger immortality quest in the Harry Potter series. But also because my middle schoolers, I teach, as most of you know, a middle school Harry Potter experience of the summer down at Ferrum College called Hogwarts Academy. And we have a strong tradition at Ferrum of performing traditional Blue Ridge Regional folk tales. Richard Chase, who collected the Jack Tales, spent some time at Ferrum and worked with a longtime member of our theater faculty. And we had a troupe called the Jack Tale Players, who played to something like 1.5 million people in 34 states between 1975 and about 2010, when they quit performing. And they used to perform regularly for our enrichment campers. Every Wednesday night, they would have a Jack Tale performance. And, you know, I've been at Ferrum long enough that we get students who come to the college who've seen the Jack Tale Players at their elementary schools when they're kids, who grow up and come to Ferrum and become Jack Tale Players. So we have this long tradition. And they had seen that Jack Tale. So the following morning, I'm walking up from the parking lot to my Hogwarts class, and I'm thinking, I don't want to give the impression I'm not usually well prepared, but we were going to talk about the Tale of Three Brothers, but I'm thinking, what can I do that's fun today? You know, what can we do that's different? And I remember when it hit me, it's a folk tale. And there's no reason that folktale couldn't be performed in the same way that our Jacktale players were performing Jacktales, using that story theater kind of methodology with a narrator and actors who were performing those roles. So we started doing that, and we videotape it, and we put it on a password-protected YouTube channel so that kids' parents can watch it when they go home. So there's no doubt in my mind what the favorite text within the text of the under 14 set is, because I've seen it over and over. And when I read that story now, you know, I see the faces of individual children who've been in my classroom, who've played those roles and who really relate to that. So again, I have this really strong emotional association.
And I have to jump back in there, because that is that folk where Jack escapes death. Jack does those kinds of things, because Harry and Jack are very similar. Neither one of them is the sharpest tool in the shed. I mean, we know that. But they live this charmed life, and they somehow, because of their innocence, because of who they are, they accomplish these amazing things.
That's right.
And so Harry as a Jack figure, I think, is just so wonderful. I love that your students brought that together.
Despite the fact that they're both underdogs.
Yes.
Yeah.
Reading beautifully.
Yeah.
That's great. You guys all did a great job with that. My contribution to that was the Dumbledore's chocolate frog card. So we don't need to talk about that. We can move on quickly.
That's great.
It is important, though. It sets up fantastic beasts. We're still working through that one. That's my only plug. Okay. All right. So now let's talk about surprise. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about those gotcha moments of narrative misdirection. J.K. Rowling is a real champ at this. And Elizabeth, start us off here. What did you think?
Can I tell my funny story about the gotcha?
Oh, sure.
That I shared? Because this is like the moment that you couldn't have made up. When I was first reading the Chamber of Secrets, I was reading those books when my son was a newborn, so I wouldn't drop him in and kill him in the night because I was really worried that I would fall asleep. And so I was reading the books, and we were in a new house, and I had just figured out that the monster was a basilisk. And I've been reading all day long, and I was supposed to be doing other stuff, I was supposed to be grading papers, but I'd gotten it figured out, I knew. And I've been hearing this strange noise on the roof all day long. And about the time that I, oh, it's a snake. It's a basilisk in the pipes. I got it. About that time, I heard this kerthump out the front of the picture windows. No. And there was this several feet long black snake that had been on the roof, apparently hunting birds. And there he went. That was the greatest timing ever. And I did drop the book.
But
not the baby. Thankfully, I was not holding the baby at the time. So that was one of those whoa moments. But those big surprise moments are just so remarkable. And we get those great narrative misdirections. But for me, you're talking about Azkaban being your favorite. I love them all. And I love parts of all of them. You know, you can't pick one. And it's, you know, as James Thomas says, it's not seven books anyway. It's one big book. It's 4,100 pages long. And it's one book. So instead of picking a book that you like, you pick sections or things you like. Cat, Rat, and Dog. When we're in the Shrieking Shack at the end of that book, it's like the steeplechase of plot twists. We just go this way and that way and the other. And that is just the best section. And that is where I think I realized, this is not your everyday kid's book. When I got to that book, because I'd been enjoying the books up to that point, and I was like, I think we're dealing with something a whole lot different here than I thought. This isn't just good children's literature. This is really good literature.
You know,
neat stuff.
What that scene connected with for me, Elizabeth, is the scene in Adventures of Huckleberry Finn when Huckleberry Finn tears up the piece of paper and he says, all right, then I'll go to hell. I mean, that's, you know, when Harry says, I don't reckon my father would want me to become a killer. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the kind of crisis of conscience scene for me.
It's wonderful. It's just this great scene where everything moves so much, and we're getting some really important pieces there. We're getting the marauders. We're getting all those things there that are going to continue to be really important, and it just goes so beautifully, and it turns. It's like a dance that she's doing. It's so, so well done, and really then quickly, not just to keep the attention of readers and that sort of thing, but the pacing is just beautiful there. And so that's a great narrative misdirection because it just keeps going. I think I've got it. Nope, turn it. And what I love is that it takes place inside a haunted house because it's like a haunted house ride. You know, if you're on whatever it is, whether it's Mr. Toad or the Haunted Mansion at Disney or any of those things, you're going along and whoop, you're going to run into this wall and then your car turns around and you're going the other way. And it's that same kind of experience. You're just kind of getting whiplash because you're turning and switching around so much. So as far as narrative misdirection goes, that's just like the show off. It's like at the figure skating competition where we're done with the competition, so now we're just going to show off. And so it's almost like we're really going, let's see how many times I can turn you around and around and around in this section. And that one really does it beautifully.
Yeah, I think that's great. And we feel like that should go on the list.
What are we calling that? Cat, Rat, and Dog.
Cat, Rat, and Dog.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I picked the moment where Neville Longbottom emerges out of Ariana Dumbledore's portrait, and he's beaten, he's battered, but he's been leading the student resistance. And yes, I mean, it wasn't complete misdirection. We'd seen Neville heading in that direction. You know, we saw a lot of this, you know, as he was developing as a character and becoming stronger in Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix. But when this, you know, kid who was, you know, such a loser in the first book, you know, the one everyone made fun
Where's
of.
Where's my toad?
The toad loser.
Where's my remember all?
Remember all. Melting his cauldrons, you know, can't pass potions, anything like that. And, you know, now he has emerged and you realize, you know, he's basically taken over for Harry in Hogwarts. He's been the saving people guy and he's, you know, he's got, you know, most of the students locked away in the safe house and he's getting them food from Hogsmeade. And, you know, it's just such a complete inversion of the character we started out with there. And I just love that. And in particular, one of my favorite moments when he is, you know, sort of filling them in on what's gone on at Hogwarts that year, and you're realizing, wow, there's an entire other book that could be written about just, you know, Hogwarts under Snape that would be a fascinating book to read sometime. But when he's talking about but one of my favorite lines in the entire book, it's Dawlish is still in St. Mungo's and Gran's on the run. He talks about the Death Eaters coming to attack his grandmother and his grandmother, you know, knocking Dawlish out, and going on the run. And of course, then she shows up later to fight with him and said, I've got to go help my grandson kill Voldemort now, excuse me, and walks off in her little vulture hat. And, you know, you had this image of this browbeaten kid and his kind of tyrannical, nasty grandmother that's raised him. And, you know, you've got this poor little kid no one likes. And now you've got someone who, in his own way, is as much a hero as Harry.
And he emerges from the tunnel. So you don't know who it's going to be. Mm-hmm. And so sort of symbolizes that.
And I just wanted to add to that's part of that larger misdirection, that Sybil Trelawney's prophecy might very well have been intended to mean Neville, not to mean Harry. That's a huge misdirection. And, you know, the way that plays out, I just think that's the work of a master storyteller. That ultimately Harry is the chosen one because he was chosen by Voldemort, because Voldemort interpreted the prophecy as applying to Harry, and that itself might have been a misdirection.
Good gotcha moment. I know, John, you have probably several.
Well, yeah, narrative misdirection. Who came up with that idea? All right, let's. That's right, Emma. All right, my big narrative misdirection scene is in Order of the Phoenix, where Rowling, I think, is honestly talking about, again, text within text, because Hermione reads the text to Harry and says, hey, this is when you do your saving people thing. And if I figured that out, then somebody else has figured that out as well. Mm-hmm. And when we get that kind of self-referencing inside the story, like, hey, we got a formula going here. And so we need a defamiliarization exercise. And buddy, you're being set up for some narrative misdirection punishment. And Harry's like, no, we gotta go. Let's jump on a thestral and get to London, because my godfather is being tortured. And Hermione's doing the, you know, I've read this book enough times. I'm thinking this saving people thing is not gonna end well. That moment when Harry does arrive inside the Department of Mysteries and realizes, wow, I have been set up. This is my saving people thing. And now all these people are gonna die. Because of my rashness, that I've followed the story formula and now I'm doomed. That misdirection catches all of us because we like the formula. We expect this to work out well, and we don't, even though Order of the Phoenix is the most painful book to read, it is the Negretto of the series. When we come to that moment, that's really the nadir of the Negretto, and it's a consequence of Rowling's genius narrative misdirection. That's the gotcha.
Harry's judgment on that has been good so far, and so he's so wrong on this one. So, you know, mine was actually much earlier. So I really thought from the very first book, my aunt gave me the books, and I thought, well, I'll read them, you know, but it's kids' literature. And when the villain that we've been set up to think is the villain turns out not to be the villain, and instead it's Quirrell. That, to me, I was like, oh, this is not a kid's book that is operating according strictly to a formula. It's making you think it's operating according to a formula, but she's gonna mix it up for you. And that's when I knew, oh, this is not just, you know, your everyday children's book.
The twist is the formula.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so that was my idea. Emily?
Well, you know, I was just all about what Louise said about Neville, when Neville comes through the tunnel at that moment. And just, you know, basically to echo what Lana said also, just Neville in general, just the fact that, you know, he undergoes this transformation that you just watch unfold until when he emerges from that tunnel, it's he's the other chosen one, you know. And I really loved how that transformation played out aesthetically with the casting. You know, they just did so
That's
well.
That's a nice way
that.
To put it, Emily.
I mean, it really, he just was so awkward. He was in that awkward, you know, Matthew Lewis was in that awkward, you know, pudgy boy stage, you know, when he was 11 or 10 or whatever. And then, you know, by the time the films are complete, he's like an Adonis, you know, and I'm like, oh my goodness, so he's posing in his underwear. It's crazy. And I'm like averting my eyes. I'm like,
I miss the underwear piece.
J.K. Rowling did not miss it. I think she tweeted about it. It was. I seem to remember it being very funny.
How about just the name Longbottom? Okay, guys. Longbottom means simultaneously a man with a large posterior, right? Just a big butt awkward person.
Uh-huh.
But bottom in the UK also means courage. And here's a man with depth.
Right? Oh, and so
when you look at Neville Longbottom, you know, his name means literally, you know, nowhere, no place, big butt. You know, this guy is lost.
Yeah.
And talk about an outlier. Talk about the alien inside he's the Peter Pettigrew equivalent of their trio with Extra. And yet we see how he is brought back into the story so that at the end he's Longbottom on courage, and he's the crucial dispatcher of Nagini in the last Horcrux that he becomes.
Right, right. That moment.
You've been saying that he's not the chosen one. Well, when he dispatches Nagini,
I mean, Neville killing Nagini
has to be
the
yes,
which was blown in the film.
We got to it. We got to it.
Yeah, but that was that's a classic, pulling the sword of Gryffindor. That's great.
It is also, Longbottom is also a place in the Shire mm-hmm. where fine pipeweed is grown.
Yes,
so
yes it is.
Just throwing that out there.
And also the idea of the long game, which I think is what Neville is the player of the long game. You know, Harry gets instant payoff every book. Woo! You know, I do something awesome at the end of every book. Neville has to wait 7 years. You know, he's like Jacob working for the wife he really wants. You know, he's just really has to get, so he's, and so at the bottom of the story, you know, at the end of things, he is the one who's played the long game. He is the one who has kind of held us all this long time. So, you know, that name that just seems like a joke, again, it's really something kind of neat.
I disagree that he has to wait 7 years because it's his points that wins the House Cup at the end of the first book. That
he always had that potential.
That Dumbledore is saying to stand up to your friends is more important or more difficult than standing up to your enemies.
I just want to ask, how does Dumbledore find the time to monitor all these, you know, Ron?
He doesn't need a
things
cloak
he knows
to be
about
invisible.
Ron.
He's an administrator. He does no grading.
Administrator, no grading. That's
he's not grading. No. Oh my gosh, that's funny. Well, here's the next topic, which is the drop the book moment. Now, John, this was the one that you suggested. That moment where you can't believe what you're reading. You have to put it down. Maybe, you know, maybe it's surprise, maybe it's something that's just profoundly affected you. So what made you think that this would be a good category for a top moment?
Well, I haven't got a snake dropping off the roof moment. I really feel
it's hard to beat.
Everything I say now is going to be, but I read the book in order to explain to my oldest daughter why we don't read trash like this. And I was captured almost from the very beginning with the charm of the story. I thought, I'm already hating these Dursleys. I'm already caught up with this. But the moment when Ferenczi says to Harry, if you drink the blood of a unicorn, no matter how close you are to death, you'll be brought back. But if you drink it unworthily, you'll be damned. That made me drop the book. And I think I've been reeling ever since. That here inside this book, she included essentially 1 Corinthians on the Eucharist. This was a subtlety and yet a powerful presentation of sort of the Christian backdrop that we're going to see with the blood. A unicorn is a traditional symbol of Christ. So he's talking about the, you know, how the blood of the unicorn has this thing. St. Paul says the exact same thing, almost word for word, inside a letter he writes to the Corinthians. That moment, literally, I remember sitting on the sofa and dropping the book thinking, what am I reading? I mean, I had to do a 360 twirl on my whole idea of this book, so much so that the next morning I said, not only can you read this book, you have to read this book, which she, of course, took as my attempt at pathetic reverse psychology, you know, and ran into the room and read it, which that's what I really wanted to do anyway. But that was my moment of just, you know, when Ferenczi channels Paul of Tarsus, you know, said, whoa, what's going on here? That was my moment.
Well, I mean, I didn't have a great answer to this one, except for I dropped the book a couple times while I was reading Cursed Child, but I don't think it was for the reasons that you're talking about.
It was more of a drop.
It was
not a classic.
It actually wasn't good enough to make me angry. Oh, it just made me drop the book.
You know, I was really stunned when Dumbledore died. John, you're looking puzzled.
You know, I thought when
I've been waiting for 2 bucks.
No, I know. I mean, I know that. I mean, I understand enough about the hero myth archetype to know that the mentor has to be dispensed with at some point along the way. But I think that the death of Sirius Black fooled me into thinking that was it for a good long while. And I suppose the fact that Dumbledore died in the very next book is what was surprising to me, not the fact that he died. And, you know, at that point, I really felt like, okay, you fulfilled this hero myth thing. Now stop with the major characters. No more. I mean, I really was both surprised by that and also surprised that I was surprised.
And my drop the book moments were out of grief, too. They were ones like that. It was really funny when by the time we got around to the Deathly Hallows, my husband and I were chasing each other around the house trying to finish. And finally, he just one day when I was doing something else, he just read the whole thing like all night long or something. He said, now you don't have to keep competing. Just sit down and read it. And I could tell by the look on his face, it's going to be bad. You know, it's bad. Mm-hmm. And he kept messing with me about, you know, how many Weasleys do you like? You know?
Oh,
just, it was terrible. He had all this leverage over me. It was just terrible. But the last, you know, that there were several sections there. It started early. It started with Hedwig, you know, all the way. But from Dobby on, you know, it's just, I didn't have to drop the book. I just sort of put it down and I went and got some cocoa. Some tissues. I went through like an entire tin of Hershey's cocoa powder in the last half of that book because that's how the Dementors, you have to keep them at bay. And so that was there were really a lot of those dropping the books, but they were those kind of moments. Just I have to put it down because those times of grief were really, really hard for me as a reader because we've invested in these people and it's really hard when we lose them.
So I'll tell you. My mine was a little different. I would say not grief so much as horror, but I really find Dolores Umbridge to be one of the most despicable villains. She exemplifies to me the idea of the banality of evil. You know, she's just an administrator, but who's also just filled with evil in the most ways that are very mundane. Mm-hmm. And in the fifth book, Harry has detention with Dolores, mm-hmm. and he's going to write lines, I must not tell lies. And she says, you won't need ink. And he starts to write, and it gets carved into his hand in a way that will be permanent. Mm-hmm. And I read that, and I was like, I think I need to take a break from the book. I couldn't even read the rest of the scene. It was just horrifying, and his powerlessness in that moment, and he has to keep going with it. Ooh, rough. I get a little upset just talking about it.
I think stuff like that touches teachers mm-hmm. even more than the average person, just because it, in sharp relief, there is the burden of our responsibility to students and how we, you know, we don't even know what students may be going through, and even but that kind of intentional cruelty is mm-hmm. just is hard to stomach, I think.
Right.
Can I say one more thing about the Dumbledore scene? The other part of that for me is not just that Dumbledore died, it's that Snape did it. And I think that was the other, and here's misdirection again. You know, every time you think you can kind of see where she's going with Snape and you think she's confirming your suspicion that this guy's going to turn out to be on the right side in the end, then this thing happens. And I mean, that's part of, I think, what makes me drop the book there.
So I think now...
I'm writing that one down, by the way.
Oh, okay.
Snape killing Dumbledore.
Oh, yes, I agree. That's a very important one, and Dumbledore's death for sure. So now let's do something quick. Let's do a rapid-fire round robin on Snape moments. Let's just do this really quickly. So favorite Snape moment or top Snape moment. Elizabeth.
Snape being inspected by Umbridge because... she's every administrator that every teacher has ever been terrified of, and he actually is the teacher we're afraid we're going to become, and it's just this incredible, great moment of, like, our greatest fears together. One place.
I like Snape's worst memory. It's a twofer. You get young Severus tortured in the living memory inside the Pensieve, and then the still grieving Severus having pulled Harry out of the Pensieve.
That's powerful. Mine was really just the first time you meet Snape, where he delivers that passionate speech about potions. And I feel like that's what I sound like when I'm talking about history. So, you know, put a stopper in death. It's good stuff.
I picked the scene with Narcissa and Bellatrix, where he is making the unbreakable vow.
Powerful.
Because I thought it was a very powerful moment. It was showing him as a very complex character. He was actually being compassionate toward this mother, Narcissa, trying to save her, or promising he would protect her son. And, you know, once you look back on that scene, once you know how everything comes out, you realize what a position he was in. After he made that vow, you know, one of three things was going to happen. Either this young boy was going to kill Dumbledore, Snape was going to kill Dumbledore, or Snape was going to die. And there were no other choices. Mm-hmm. And when you think of him going back and thinking of him going over those three choices in his head, you know, what was that like? And the fact that he did that for an entire school year. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that was a powerful Snape moment for me.
Mine is basically the same as Elizabeth's, but I will just cull it down to one word, which is obviously.
I can cull it down to one word too, but mine is always. I think for a character like Snape to be able to bring himself to that vulnerability, not to think it, but to say it aloud, I think that's great.
That's wonderful. All right, so I think we have gotten to the part where we're going to take the big question, because all of us probably have at least one scene that we feel like is the most important, the one that we think about, return to, or that changed our lives. And so, you know, what would you say is the scene that you just go back to over and over again? Elizabeth?
That King's Cross scene is just so incredible in so many ways. And for me as a teacher, though, I tend to quote those great literary critics that my students never have heard of, like the great literary critic Obi-Wan Kenobi, who tells us that the way we see the world depends on our point of view. You know? But I often quote the great literary critic Albus Dumbledore, "Of course it's all happening inside your head. Why on earth should that mean it isn't real?" And I just butchered it. Such a great line. But what's so wonderful about that is it helps me to help students understand when I'm in a mythology class, when we're trying to understand the numinous, to understand how the things that we don't see are just as real and sometimes even more than the things around us, the things we can touch and feel, the tactile world. That is just, that's the scene to me that's the takeaway for so much. And because this story that's brought us all here together, we're all here for this weekend, we're all doing all these things, for a story that all happened inside someone's head, and that happens inside our heads, and happens inside our heads every time we read it. So to me, that's the moment I come back to. It's the one I quote the most. It's the one that I just sometimes hear in my head when I think, this is kind of strange. And I hear Dumbledore, well, that doesn't mean it's not real just because it's happening inside your head.
And I'm sure, are you writing that down, Emily? I think that's got to be a top moment.
This isn't a very brave choice. Rowling herself said in an interview in Spain in 2007 that she waited 17 years to write those lines, and that it is the key to the whole series. I mean, that moment is, if you get it, if you understand, dare I say, logos epistemology, that if you get what Rowling is after in that moment in terms of a transformed vision, and about what Harry represents in terms of his that soul triptych, that, you know, and when Harry comes to this awareness of himself, so that when he returns to the story and they begin to circle one another, Harry has become the center of the circle and the Dark Lord is weaponless. Seriously, that's the moment of transformation. If the reader doesn't get it, it's understandable because it's a very busy scene. You turn the page immediately to find out what's going on. You may think that Dumbledore is giving some sort of relativist comment. Oh, it's only in your head. Don't worry about it. But then when you wrestle with it, there's nuance upon nuance and upon depth that you're going to want to explore in that side of that line.
Yeah, that's great. Now, Louise, what about you? What would you say?
Well, Elizabeth stole mine, of course. So I
a lot of people had this. Yeah,
but so I'm gonna pick a different one. I'm going to say, in the scene at the very end when Voldemort and Harry are circling each other and Harry tells him, try for some remorse. Mm-hmm. I think that is a very, and he's calling him Tom. Mm-hmm. And I just love that, that even Voldemort, if he had been able to muster up some remorse at that point, might have been redeemable. And of course he couldn't. And, you know, Dumbledore probably, of course, knew he couldn't, which is why he said that the little fetus thing under the chair in King's Cross was beyond our, mm-hmm. our hope. But I just love it. You know, try for some remorse, Tom. Mm-hmm. I'll pick that as a runner up.
Well, anybody who knows me could answer this question for you, because it's the line that I attached to all my email from the scene at the end of Chamber of Secrets when Harry and Dumbledore are talking and Dumbledore speaks the line, it is our choices, Harry, that show who we truly are far more than our abilities. I've quoted that line so many times. I've quoted it to freshmen in the speech that's supposed to kind of, you know, get them to think about the trajectory of their college career. It's in the welcome on our honors program greeting page and my greeting there. It's the principle I attempt to practice daily in my life and the principle I hope my children will follow. It is our choices that show who we really are far more than our abilities.
And I think that's probably got to be one of the top 20 also. It's such an important idea that she says it very early, but it carries all the way through the books.
And, you know, it applies ultimately to Voldemort as well, because what shaped mm-hmm. his entire confrontation, the extended confrontation with Harry, is his choosing to believe that the prophecy applied to Harry.
That's good stuff. So mine is, as you might guess, it has to do with Dobby. Dobby is one of my favorite characters of all time, really. And to me, it's Dobby's noble self-sacrifice. And I love it when he stands up and says, Dobby has no master. Ah, I just transported in that. To me, that's just such an expression of, you know, you may enslave me, but I'm never your slave. I am my own. I have no master. And that's the moment of his sacrifice, I think, is important too. Emily, you had suggested we have a category called like the ugly cry category. And that's my ugly cry category too. But to me, the idea that somebody who starts out so powerless and actually self-defeating in so many ways, but because he gains freedom and he works at it, he has to work really hard at it, he's able to embrace that at the exact moment when it's most desperately needed for the power of good.
And my scene that changed my life has to do with, but by the way, you reminded me of, I'm a person. My name's Anakin, and I'm a person. Like the line from The Phantom Menace. It's like, oh, that's so Dobby. It's probably why people didn't like that.
No, Anakin and Dobby.
Well, like I said, it's probably why people didn't like that. Dobby, it's the scene that changed my life, too. Because at first I couldn't understand why Harry, and it's actually not the scene where Dobby dies. It's the scene right after when Harry buries him without using magic. And I couldn't, it troubled me. And I couldn't figure out, you know, I read it, and when did it come out? July? Read it in July. And it wasn't until the following spring, because I was sitting at Holy Thursday service at my parish, and they're washing the feet. And it had always bothered me why Harry didn't use magic. It's like, why not for this? You know, why? And then all of a sudden, I'm realizing we're singing this song, you know, that says, in a time to come, you will know what I have done. Let me wash you. Let me serve. Mm-hmm. This is my example. Love as I loved you. And I'm like, oh my gosh, he was washing Dobby's feet. He had removed his outer cloak and he was humbling himself in front of his disciples, doing this radical act of service. And in John's gospel, this is the Eucharist. There is no account of this event gets totally, it totally overshadows the meal. And it becomes this connection to show the disciples that Eucharist means radical acts of humiliating service. It's dirty work. And this is what Harry does. He gets dirt all over himself. And he's muddy. And in that grave, he comes to understand that what is needed of him. And that's what scholars say about the foot washing in John's gospel. They say this moment prefigures Christ's more radical sacrifice the next day. I mean, it just totally blew me away. It just gave me the best kind of soul chills, and it changed my life. It definitely changed my life. It's just beauty.
And I want to throw in here that less listeners think that this is something that, you know, Emily's projecting her pathetic Christian beliefs onto the text.
That's okay. I don't mind.
That if you do the calculation on the dates, Ginny is home at the time because it's Easter vacation. That he buries Dobby on Easter Sunday.
Oh my goodness.
That Rowling's not very good at maths, as she says, but she has her dates down, and she without saying it out loud, she's saying quite clearly that when Harry enters into the grave and then climbs out of his grave on Easter morning, and he's chosen to pursue
Horcruxes, not Hallows.
That's right. That he has made a choice to follow that eye, that transformed vision inside the mirror. He's recognized that within himself as this, basically the kingdom, the ruling power within him is what he's going to identify with, rather than his ego concerns and identity, just as Dobby has shown him in his example, that the least among us has shown us the highest path.
And that's true freedom. That is the true freedom that Dobby has learned. Hence, to give one's life for one's friends.
When you said, you know, that the Dobby moment when he says, I have no master, to me the Dobby moment is, here lies Dobby, mm-hmm. a free elf.
Mm-hmm. I can't say that out loud and not cry, John. So,
well, you should know that.
The epitaph, which must not be named.
You do.
Yeah, that's right. That's what we'll call it.
When I talk about this at lectures, I mean, Travis Prinzi teases me about this. He says, Johnny, I know this line is coming. You do it in every talk, and yet I still laugh. And that is that if you don't cry when Dobby dies, you need to have your medication adjusted, because there are crack dealers in Philadelphia that cried when Dobby died. You know, this is not a moment that you can be a tough guy and tough out there.
Such a poetic way to put that, John. So, look, I think we've definitely explored so many parts.
This is going
of
on the list, right?
Yeah,
right.
I think we have to put that on the list. But we are basically out of time. We have had such a great discussion, though, that's just been wonderful. I think we could probably go on and talk for hours more about this, but I think
we will tomorrow
hit the highlights. We will. We're going to do some more panels tomorrow. And just for the listeners out there, if you've missed the Harry Potter Festival in Roanoke this year, we anticipate, right, Lana? There will be one next year, we think.
That's the plan.
So you can make your schedule accordingly and try to join us next year. So Bloomsbury is planning to release their video of the top 20 Harry Potter moments June 26th for the 20th anniversary of the release of Philosopher's Stone. And so we are going to stay tuned and see if our choices make it on the list. I hope you liked our choices, but please also tell us what your choices are in the comment box. Leave those, and we would love to start the next episode talking about what you think we left out through this wide-ranging conversation that we've had. And I really need to thank all of the Hogwarts faculty who are here at the Roanoke Festival. Louise Freeman, Emily Strand, Lana Whited, who has put this Roanoke Harry Potter Fest together, Elizabeth Baird Hardy, and of course, our resident expert, John Granger. I appreciate all of you being here. I just feel as though, you know, we're all kindred spirits in this, and it's such a wonderful experience to see, to just be in the same room with you all talking about our favorite moments. So I really appreciate you all being here. Thank you very much. I'll leave you with one of my favorite quotes from the book, The Wisdom of Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore, who said, "Words are, in my not so humble opinion, our most inexhaustible source of magic, capable of both inflicting injury and remedying it." So we'll see you next time, we hope, where we'll be using our words to make some magic.